Well, I'm very pleased to be joined today by Mr. John Connorton, who is a partner at Hawkins, Delafield & Wood, which is a Wall Street law firm here in the city, but was also involved in the Irish peace process, which we're going to talk about today. First time I said, welcome, Mr. Connorton.
Tim, I'm very happy to be here and in the offices of America Magazine, a great publication.
Well, a longtime reader, a friend of the magazine. And since you have some inside perspective on the tumultuous years in Northern Ireland and some of the figures, including Ian Paisley, who just died on Friday at the age of 88. First, maybe you can just explain your part in this whole process, this what's happened over the last 20 years.
Well, I mean, basically, I've been involved in the peace and reconciliation process in Northern Ireland for over 30 years and probably worked most closely with John Hume, Nobel Peace Prize winner, winner of the Gandhi Prize and the Martin Luther King Prize. And I worked very closely with John in the 80s and the 90s, also with other members of the leadership in Northern Ireland, and basically promoting peace and reconciliation through a variety of means, including economic development and, as it's called in Northern Ireland, inward investment.
Now, I want to mention two things here at the top because they are relevant. One is that you've received an honorary degree from the University of Ulster for your work. You were also named by Queen Elizabeth II an honorary commander of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire for your work. So that is very impressive. We want to talk about Ian Paisley. We were just talking before that this is somebody you didn't know necessarily personally, but certainly you were in the room with him. You knew, of course, of his involvement in this process. What were your general impressions of him over those years?
Well, if you look at the last 30 years and even beyond that, I think the newspaper obituaries and the media have captured pretty well the fact that this was a man who was a demagogue, a firebrand, a troublemaker, frankly, a bigot, a militant. His famous words were no or never or not an inch, and Ulster will not surrender, no surrender. Having said that, and there are many, frankly, distasteful stories and anecdotes that anybody who was Catholic in Northern Ireland or even in the United States could resurrect to remind our listeners just how far this man came in the last years of his life. There is no question that the peace process would not have advanced to the stage it is at right now without the leadership and even the courage of Ian Paisley. The price he paid for that was, frankly, as the commentators are now mentioning on his death and the funeral arrangements, it's a private family gathering, mainly because, while it's obviously instinctively something that is private and personal to a family, the political speculation is it was sort of a reproach to his own church, which he established, where he became, from which he became alienated as a result of the peace process, and also his party. The price he paid was he died a lonelier man than he might have had he stuck to his original principles, the principles that many of us found so abhorrent.
Right. I mean, just to, for the record, he had at one point called Pope John Paul II the Antichrist. So this is, he didn't mince words. He was really vehemently anti-Catholic. So that's for a lot of people, that's what they remember about him. How do we explain this conversion that happened? Was it around the time of the Good Friday Accords, so like 2000?
Well, he opposed the Good Friday Agreement.
Initially, right, yeah.
Yes, and he opposed almost every effort for peace and reconciliation before that. And while I think he deserves credit for his participation and his leadership, no less a personage than George Mitchell has said in recent days that but for Ian Paisley's participation, the peace process would not have taken, fragile though it may be right now, it would not have been successful. And I agree with that. I mean, my own feeling is the greatest statesman in the last 50 years in on the island of Ireland has been John Hume. John Hume stood in stark contrast with Ian Paisley, but nonetheless, they did make common cause at different times. And even though they were fiercely opposed to each other's points of view, There was a grudging respect. We are only a day after the funeral of Ian Paisley. It may be a little early to look at Paisley without tears, but as a general proposition, I think history will record that he did a complete about-face. He turned around and made the peace process possible. Why did that happen? Interesting question. There'll be lots of speculation. In my law practice, I've been privileged we are the nation's largest public finance law firm, and our clients are states and municipalities. In the 1980s, I had a chance to do a number of financings in the state of Alabama when George Wallace had come back for his fifth term. And the George Wallace in his fifth term was a very different George Wallace than the George Wallace those of us who were in the civil rights movement had known. I'm somebody who made the March on Washington with Martin Luther King in 1963. I was there for his famous I Have a Dream speech, which was one of the things that inspired me to work with John Hume, because King was a hero. But back to Wallace, Wallace, in his last term, made a determined effort to reach out to the African-American community in Alabama, and one of his senior and closest advisors told me privately, there's really no excuse for what we did, you know, in the 50s. And I think Wallace was trying in some respects to redeem himself. I like to believe that Ian Paisley had sort of the same awakening. I would say to Catholics, Ian Paisley was our George Wallace in one sense. But, you know, perhaps it was age, perhaps it was a realization that there was genuine movement on the part of Sinn Féin and the IRA to renounce violence. I think he believed them. And I think the friendship, or at least the relationship he developed with Martin McGuinness in the ensuing years, which led McGuinness to say, at his death, I have lost a friend. I think there was a belief that this was a gamble, this was a task worth taking. Paisley explained it himself by saying there had been repentance. I'm not sure history will reveal that he got the repentance that he was looking for, but there was enough of it to allow him to embrace the peace process. And he paid a price for it at the end.
Just to place this in historical context, as we were discussing, we go from 1998 when an initial peace agreement was signed. He was very much against it. Then moving along, it was not until 2007 that he actually accepted a power-sharing compromise. And he became the first minister in Belfast.
Well, right, and that was a very nice enticement. He was going to become the first minister, and somebody who had been an outsider. Don't forget that as much as he vilified Catholics and popes, and it wasn't just limited to one pope, there was a series of popes that he had comments about, he basically was, I think, embracing the possibilities. He would be first minister, but he also was showing other unionists that he was the big man, that he was the leader. He had been vilifying unionists, other leadership, the unionist leadership. And don't forget the DUP, the party, the Democratic Ulster Unionist Party, that he helped found in 1971, was the minority party, where the Ulster Unionist Party, headed by David Trimble and Reg Empey, were the majority unionist party, and he was sort of the outlier. He was getting, when he joined the peace process and joined the government as first minister, he was declaring a political victory as well.
Also, I mean, he also received some other, like, was he named a peer of the realm? That was another.
Yes. Whether that was the ultimate inducement, I do not know. But both he and his wife, who is a baroness, were honored by the British government with that. I don't think that alone was what persuaded him to make movement, but it was one of the dividends of the process.
Now, you mentioned John Hume. He was quoted, I believe, in the last few, just saying this is sort of an end of an era. Do you think that's the case?
Well, it is the end of an era. I'd like to believe it's the end of an era where such vile bigotry would be tolerated. There, if you had sort of the 10 top quotes of Ian Paisley over the years, that's sort of a David Letterman top 10 list, I think a lot of people today would be appalled at what he was saying. That language and rhetoric had left the United States dialogue probably in the 30s and the 40s. You'd have to go back to the Al Smith campaign in 1928 to find such open, discriminatory, vile rhetoric directed at any group. And he certainly leveled it at Catholics, Catholic leadership, ridiculing Catholic beliefs, mocking the Eucharist. There were just any number of different things that one could say, good riddance, thank God that day is largely gone, we hope. Having said that, I thought Martin McGuinness's comment in one of the Belfast papers was very interesting. He said, I just wish that Ian Paisley had been 25 years younger when he went into government. He was implying the things we could have accomplished together. Martin McGuinness's relationship with Ian Paisley, I think, was much better than it is with Peter Robinson, who is the successor to Ian Paisley. Don't forget that the press had dubbed Ian Paisley and Martin McGuinness the Chuckle Brothers because of their friendship. And I personally watched that chemistry both in Northern Ireland at Hillsborough Castle, where we participated in a dinner with both of them and a number of others, and also here in New York. Martin McGuinness and Ian Paisley were here in New York as First Minister and Deputy First Minister only a few years ago, not far from here, over at the University Club for a very fine lunch. And the chemistry was terrific. But I think the comment that McGuinness made is an important one. He just regrets that Paisley had not been 25 or 30 years younger when he went into government, because they might have accomplished more. On the other hand, another way to look at it is if Paisley was there with 25 or 30 years of political life ahead of him, he might have been less willing to compromise.
Now, of course, it's an interest of ours, being a Jesuit magazine, the Christian element here. I mean, is there something to be said that, I mean, obviously we're looking at the ugly side of some of his beliefs, but in terms of finally coming to this moment of conversion, the fact that there was this Christian narrative that they shared on some level, do you think that helped?
Well, I do. Many years ago when I was at Holy Cross College, the Holy Cross Alumni Magazine published a terrific full issue on the Troubles in 1972, and Bloody Sunday took place during that year. A Jesuit priest famously said the only hope for Northern Ireland that it be converted to Christianity. And he was really referring to undoubtedly Ian Paisley and the hatred and bile that was being spewed from the pulpit. I think he was also referring to some of the unchristian-like conduct and behavior of those who had taken up the gun. We can debate, and history will debate, whether it was self-defense, et cetera. But nonetheless, war brings out the worst in all of us. And I think that's what he was really, he was not trying to take sides, nor am I in this particular comment. Do I think Christianity played a role here? Yes, I do think that Ian Paisley, who has written and preached the Gospels for so long, perhaps selectively, but nonetheless has preached them, perhaps age and the moment was ripe. And he did talk about, you know, the possibility of repentance. And he was talking about not really so much his own, but others. But I think in the quiet moments of the evening, he probably had to reflect on his own conduct. Yes, I think, I assume he persuaded himself that it was time to forgive and time to embrace. And of course, others did the same. And I would say, you know, speaking of forgiveness, Martin McGuinness deserves credit for reaching out to the hand that was offered. So, yes, there is. By the way, not to go off on another subject, but there were many of Ian Paisley's views, such as on abortion, where he found himself in agreement with a number of the Catholic clergy and laity. And there were a number of his more fundamentalist views that were welcomed in some parts of the Catholic community in the North. Having said that, I don't think there are few, if any, Catholics in the North of Ireland who felt that Ian Paisley really spoke for them, especially with his vile rhetoric about the Pope and Catholicism, et cetera. But in the end, I like to believe that basic Christian values of forgiveness were a motivating factor. But that's between him and his God, because I do not know.
Well, I think that's a good note to end on. We want to thank John Connorton for sharing some time with us to speak about Ian Paisley. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.